Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Brought to you by ReliefFactor.com. $19.95 gets you started on ReliefFactor.com. I talk about it three times in my daily show. At the bottom of the first hour when I take it, and then in hours two and three when I remind you to take it, depending on when your commute begins, because ReliefFactor.com works. It's the only supplement I've taken in 30 years of broadcasting. I've declined every other opportunity to take a supplement, and I'll tell you why. Because ReliefFactor.com actually works. I carry in Curcumin Resveratrol Omega. Temporary relief for the relief of minor aches and pains. Temporary support for the relief of minor aches and pains. And you can't do better than that three-week starter pack, $19.95. Morning, glory, America. Bonjour, hi, Canada. It's Hugh Hewitt. Good morning to you. It's a great Thursday. Inside the Beltway, it's raining. I'm back in Seb Gorka's studio as I continue to work like Christopher Lloyd in Back to the Future on my own studio. All day long, I've got my helmet on and my tours and my gas lit thing, that the torch that goes on, and I'm in there welding. And Generalissimo just left me high and dry. He came back here when I was in California and really screwed this thing up. And so I'm rewiring everything all day long. But thank you, Seb, for letting me use your studio twice this week. I've got to tell you, there's a lot to cover this morning. There's a lot to cover. The Republicans told you that the Democrats would be radical, and you did not believe them because of Slow Joe. You thought old Slow Joe Biden was going to be fine, and he just mosey around like Lyndon Johnson or Jack Kennedy, and it turns out he's more radical than anyone on that show. But, of course, he only talked to center-left media types in the course of the entire campaign, and the debates were rigged by the Presidential Debate Commission, which has not yet been disbanded, but we ought to be working on disbanding that decrepit, failing institution. And so he got into power without ever taking a position on, for example, court packing or reparations. And House Democrats are moving to expand the Supreme Court with a bill that will expand it from 9 to 13. That's not unconstitutional. They could try that. And I want every Democrat to vote on that. It's got nothing to do with reconciliation, so it can't get through the Senate. But I want every House Democrat to go on record what they are in favor of. Ruth Bader Ginsburg was against it. Stephen Breyer is against it. Every sane person in America is against it because it undermines the rule of law and makes law simple majoritarian. We'll have a Supreme Court of 540 people before long. We'll just keep expanding it whenever the House changes and the Senate changes and the presidency aligns. They'll just blow through a court packing scheme. It's never happened in the United States before. But these are radical Democrats. Nancy Pelosi's a radical. Joe Biden is a radical, though he's old Slow Joe. He's surrounded by radical. They are hard left. I told you that. You didn't believe me. You didn't like the mean tweets, so you got rid of President Trump. And now you've got, not only that, you've also got Senate reparations. You've got an incoherent health care policy, the damage done to the Johnson & Johnson and vaccine rollout I'm going to come back to in a second. And you've got give up and run away in Afghanistan. Now, there is a legitimate difference of opinion on how many people we should have left there and what we should have had at Bagram. You know, Fortress Bagram would have been fine. Air support would have been fine for the Afghan National Police and the Afghan Army. But we're just up and leaving. I saw former National Security Advisor O'Brien on with Larry Kudlow yesterday supporting the decision. I'm not sure about the timeline and certainly not the symbolism of quitting and running away on 9/11. That one, I don't know who cooked that one up entirely. That's like somebody who was anti-war. One of the Code Pink people must be working for Joe Biden to come up with leave on 9/11. We'll talk with people about that today. We've got lots of great guests today. But I thought I would start with the vaccine fiasco, which is now under increasing pressure. Now, I have a great in-law. My son's father-in-law actually knows a lot about the drug process. He worked for Big Pharma for a long time and processed drugs. And he understands the mindset at the FDA, as does the official toxicologist of the Hugh Hewitt Show, a PhD toxicologist who took a half dozen drugs all the way from development to market. over a 35-year career, and it's about 7 to 10 years per cycle, except when you have an emergency pandemic sweeping the globe, and then you take extraordinary measures like Donald Trump did with Operation Warp Speed, and you break the rules at the FDA and the CDC, and then you really put your shoulder to getting people to take the vaccine for a variety of reasons. Primarily, we got to get ahead of this and kill it off before it evolves, before it iterates, before it goes through changes, as all viruses do, and adapts to something that the vaccines that we have are insufficient to counter. And we're racing to get the United States vaccinated so it becomes fortress virus, and then to expand that protection to the world. Now, they're not going to be able to get Pfizer in the jungle regions of Brazil. Not going to work. No refrigeration. Not going to work in Uganda. Isn't going to work in Cambodia. You're going to have to take a vaccine there that does not require super refrigeration, because only the United States and Europe has this kind of infrastructure. And so AstraZeneca and Johnson & Johnson are that drug. And you've got to make sure that people understand how safe they are. So the decision to pause the Johnson & Johnson decision was a catastrophe for worldwide public health. And pretty quickly, when you've got the New York Times and the Washington Post looking at it and reporting with eyes raised, saying, what in the world have they done? You realize that the people running the CDC and all the doctors and all the scientists and all the king's horses and all the king's men can't put together what they broke already. New York Times, Benjamin Mueller, Western warnings tarnish COVID vaccines that the world badly needs. That's the New York Times. Washington Post, CDC vaccine advisors seek more data on rare blood clots before deciding whether to resume Johnson & Johnson shots. Let me tell you right now, they're going to resume the shots. Why? Because the overwhelming calculus of risk factor here for any person with a brain is one death in 8 million. With a second person, it could be two deaths in 8 million, unless this person recovers, is not a reason to pause a vaccine that could kill off the variants that could kill off millions. Right? We've had millions of people die from COVID around the world. Millions of people die. Millions of people got sick. The cost of COVID is extraordinary. There isn't any debate. We need these vaccines. Thank you, Donald Trump, for doing Operation Warp Speed, doing the guaranteed purchases of Pfizer, which gave them financial guarantees, giving other people startup money, giving other people. I mean, they just threw money at it. They said, all you scientists, refocus, get it done. Operation Warp Speed worked. There are four vaccines in the world, five if you count the Russia. And props to the Russian scientists and Vladimir Putin for getting that done. Anthony Fauci said on this show, it looks good. The science looks good. Now, New York Times, amid a deep residue of mistrust, American and European cautions on AstraZeneca and Johnson & Johnson risk igniting anti-vaccine fervor in countries that can't afford to be particular. They're not particular. This is not a dangerous drug. This is not. It just isn't. That's crazy to think. They have no idea of risk. So they got the FDA panel together yesterday, according to the Washington Post, and they studied and they said, we'll get back to you. We'll get back to you. They had seven women between the ages of 18 and 14 developed thrombotic symptoms, most often headaches, 6 to 13 days after vaccination. One vaccine recipient, a Virginian woman, tragically died in March. Another is in critical condition. Two have been discharged. Three remained in the hospital. So we've had 2 out of 8 million. 2 out of 8 million. I mean, those aren't lottery shots. Those are not even lottery odds. But you are more, there it is likelier that the Browns would have won when they were 0-16 the Super Bowl at the beginning of the season than to get a blood clot from this thing. And the share of people who thought the vaccine was very or somewhat unsafe increased overnight from 26% to 39%. Do you understand that? What they did in one day because they're dummies? Because they are really, really smart people with no world experience at all. They should have asked me. They should have asked anybody in the media who deals with ratings, who knows how to deal with general public opinion, who knows how to message. They should have asked a political consultant. They should have asked the president. He might have gotten up from his nap and felt clear-headed and said, yeah, you know, that we're not going to do that. No, they didn't ask anybody. They did the science thing. They said, oh, well, you know, we don't want anyone to get sick. Nobody at all, ever. And if anybody gets sick, we're not going to do any more. And that's what the FDA has been doing for years, which is why there are so few new drugs coming to market, which is why it's a they had to pass the right to try law, because people were dying, absolutely dying, with potential life-saving therapies that they weren't allowed to use because it might hurt them. That's the FDA way. And the Chicago way is the same. You bring an FDA person, we'll bring Donald Trump. It took Donald Trump to smash up that bureaucracy. And the only explanation for what they did is that they had to flex their muscles and prove that we're not Dr. So-and-so for no reason. We have white coats and we can read statistical regression and we know that what's going on here and we've done this forever and nobody screws with us. So they pushed back and they screwed up the world completely. And if a variant comes back to the United States from the third world that could have been stopped, it is the fault of the FDA if it comes back to the United States. Remember that. I'll be right back on the Hugh Hewitt Show. Lots of liberals and lefties when I was an undergraduate years and years ago. And one of them was a guy named John Relman, wonderful lawyer. And then I go to law school at Michigan 2 years later. John was a year behind me at Harvard. And I took 2 years off and went to work for Richard Nixon. And I don't know where John went, but it could have been the Soviet Union. And he's not a radical or anything, just lefty. And John came back and we went to Michigan Law together and we had a lot of fun together. We watched the 1980 election together. And we both don't remember much about that night for the different reason. My dad had given me, upon going to law school, a bottle of 30-year-old scotch. Back in the days when I thought scotch was food, to paraphrase the wonderful senator from Wyoming, whose name I can't remember right now, and Alan Simpson. And when the night turned bad for the Democrats, John drank out of sorrow and I drank out of joy. And Ronald Reagan was president. We won the Senate and it was a great night. But Roman and I, we're old friends. We're old friends. We can give each other a hard time. And we have in between us a couple other lefties, Mark Guerin and Dan Poneman. And I mean, I just know lefties. They're everywhere. And I love them all. They're not rotten. They're just wrong. But John has done great civil rights work forever. So I know civil rights lawyers who have committed their entire life to civil rights law. And I know that they are not necessarily going to be radical in government jobs. They might be. But one of them has been nominated to become the head of the Civil Rights Division. And I would say this, that if you don't want hard left people running the Office of Civil Rights, then you would say Kristen Clark, who is the president and executive director of the National Lawyer Committee for Civil Rights under the law, which is hard left as it gets. You don't want her to be confirmed as the assistant attorney general for civil rights. Now, there have been some very conservative people to run the Civil Rights Division, like Brad Reynolds, back in the day when I was at Justice. And you're never going to expect Merrick Garland and Joe Biden to appoint a conservative. You would expect a liberal or even a leftist, someone like John Relman. But Kristen Clark is way out there. I mean, way out there. So yesterday, they had a hearing for her. And Dick Durbin is chairman. They got Dianne Feinstein to step aside. I nudged her out. They're trying to get her to resign so Gavin Newsom can appoint himself and end the recall in California. But Ted Cruz, who's a pretty good lawyer, Ted Cruz, I think he's 9 for 9 in front of the Supreme Court. Ted Cruz tried to ask DOJ's Kristen Clark a few questions, but Dick Durbin threw himself between the witness and the senator, which was unusual, to stop it. Cut number two.
Ms. Clark, you know you're testifying under oath here.
Please allow her to...
You just said
Senator
a moment
Cruz,
ago...
Senator Cruz, please allow her to complete her answers.
Well, I'm not going to allow her to filibuster, so I'm going to ask a question. If she wants to answer the question that I asked, she can do so, but I'm not going
to... She should
gonna...
be allowed. I hope you'll show respect to the witness.
Show respect to every witness, but we also have limited time, as you're aware, and you've been on this committee long enough to know that witnesses... In avoiding questions, we'll try to filibuster on different topics. So I'm going to ask questions, and I'm going to expect answers to the questions I ask. And I understand the chairman wants to jump in and defend the witnesses, but that's your prerogative to try to do so.
I will defend witnesses on either side and members on either side. We will be respectful in this committee. I hope that all members will.
I hope and expect the same standard will be applied to senators on both sides. Now, let's return to, you just said... You don't support cutting funds from police. I find that astonishing and, Ms. Clark, frankly, not credible, because I'm holding the article you wrote, and I actually pulled out a highlighter, and highlighted the beginning of each paragraph going through. And about midway through, you have a paragraph that says, we must invest less in police and more in social workers. The next paragraph is, we must invest less in police and more in social support to our schools. The next paragraph begins, we must invest less in police and more in mental health aid. Three paragraphs in your article, you begin with the words, we must invest less in police. And you just told this committee under oath you don't support investing less in police. How do you square those?
If I may, Senator, I support the fact that President Biden is committing $300 million new dollars for the COPS program, $300 million new dollars for resources to the police. I wrote that op-ed without having the power of the purse string behind me and talked about how we can allocate a limited pool of resources in a more effective way.
So you believe you were wrong last year when you called for defunding the police and investing less in the police?
It's a poor title chosen by the editor.
It's not just the title, it's your text. We must invest less in police. Three paragraphs, you begin with those words. You wrote those words. Do you agree with those words today?
Without the power of the purse string, I wrote those words. But President Biden is committing more resources to police, and I think that's a great thing, Senator.
So, you heard Dick Durbin. Now comes Tom Cotton. Again, part of the Harvard Law School caucus in the Senate, and there are many. The Harvard Law School caucus that is running for president includes Cotton and Cruz and Pompeo and DeSantis. Four Harvard lawyers. I don't know if Josh Hawley is running for president. They're going to let a Yaley run for president, too, a Yale Law School person. Senator Cotton jumps in. Cut number three.
Ms. Clark, was Officer Darren Wilson justified when he shot and killed Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri in 2014?
So there is a trial underway right now, Senator, and I, like millions of people, am sitting back and watching the trial as it plays out, and I'm prepared to accept the verdict of the jury.
In November of 2020, just a few months ago, that was not exactly what you said. You said that on this day, a grand jury chose not to indict Darren Wilson for the killing of Michael Brown. It's a powerful reminder of why we need to make clear that Black Lives Matter. We must demand that the Department of Justice resume pattern practice investigations and expand prosecutions involving police shootings. I would also point out that Eric Holder's Department of Justice in March 2015 conducted an extensive review of Officer Darren Wilson's conduct and concluded that it did not support the filing of criminal charges. They issued an 87-page report that was done under the watch of your fellow nominee, Vanita Gupta, I might add. In fact, there have been three separate investigations that have cleared Officer Wilson of wrongdoing. And just last year, however, just last year in June, you sent a letter to Congress in which you described the Michael Brown case as, quote, prosecutorial decisions not to indict police because of impenetrable qualified immunity for police and acquittals based on racism, end quote. Why do you continue, despite all this evidence to the contrary, from many of your fellow Democrats, to refuse to take an answer on whether, or take a position on whether Officer Darren Wilson was justified or not in the shooting of Michael Brown?
And Senator, if I can, I want to correct my answer. I indicated that there was a trial still going on, which is not the case. So I just want to offer up that correction. I think that in general, there is a need for greater police accountability. There is a bipartisan agreement on this issue. I know that this body did a lot of work last year.
Ms. Clark, those are all policy questions, and we'd have that policy debate. But I'm asking you a simple factual question. Was Officer Darren Wilson justified or not in the shooting of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri in 2014? Vanita Gupta has said he was. Eric Holder has said he was. Three different investigations have said he was. I'm asking you, was he or was he not justified in that shooting?
As a private citizen, based on the facts that I know, I'm not privy to the details that the federal government may have been privy to in the course of its investigation. As a private citizen, there is something that feels unfair. And
the Department of Justice issued an 87-page report. That's not a private, that's not grand jury sensitive information. That's not secret. It's an 87-page report released by Vanita Gupta when she ran the office that you aspire to lead. It concluded that the shooting was justified.
All right. Well, my
you obviously do not want to take the position that the shooting was justified despite what Eric Holder and Vanita Gupta have said, given the fact that you won't answer the simple question yes or no. Let's turn to another case, which is Jacob Blake.
Senator, could you please just allow her opportunity to respond?
Could you please stop your pattern of interrupting me repeatedly? This happened the last time we had a hearing.
I'm sorry.
You called a vote in violation of this committee's rules.
I will give you additional time, but I'd like to give her a chance to complete her answer.
I've asked her a simple yes or no question multiple times. She refuses to answer it. Thank you, though, for your input.
Dick Durbin is sitting there thinking, what have they done? You know, I didn't know until yesterday that Cotton got onto judiciary. And I talk to Cotton often, like once a week on this show, and the senator from Arkansas keeps me in the dark about many things. And I'm looking at Judiciary Committee, which is like murderer's row for Democratic nominees. I can't wait. You know, Breyer's going to quit. He's going to quit in June. Everybody knows it. He's pretending to give a hard time, but he's going to quit. And then we're going to get a Supreme Court nominee, and we're going to have fun in the summer. And your ranking member is Chuck Grassley, and he's a gentleman, old school. He doesn't give anyone too hard of a time. Lindsey Graham can be pretty brassy. John Cornyn, former Supreme Court Justice from Texas, he knows what he's doing. Michael Lee is not afraid to bring up the Federalist Papers. Then we get the murderer's row. Ben Sasse, he's just a Yaley with a lot of history behind him, and he likes to quote the Federalist Papers. Then we get to the middle of the lineup. Josh Hawley, Tom Cotton, and Ted Cruz. Now, John Kennedy and Tom Tillis are good chuckles, and they ask tough questions, and they got good staff. But you put Hawley, Cotton, and Cruz up there, bingo, bango, jingo, jango, and no nominee is going to escape without, you know, it's going to look like Zorro when they're done. Marsha Blackburn bats ninth. All right, so she always gets on base, too. She's coming up next hour. But I pity the man. I pity the man. I pity the fool.
Yeah, remember Mr. T? I pity
Mr. T. I pity the fool. That's got to go into the Judiciary Committee. When did Cotton get on the Judiciary Committee? That is freaking hilarious. I love that. He's on Senate Intel and Armed Services. He's got the best committee. I think Mitch is trying to keep him in the Senate and trying to persuade him not to run for president. Now, I've told everyone my informal ranking is there's a top tier of four people. Cotton, DeSantis, and Pompeo, the Harvard lawyers, and then Chris Christie, the New Jersey brawler. That's my unofficial top tier for 2024. And they're all buddies, right? They're all buddies. I mean, Christie's an outsider. Christie just brings roundhouse after roundhouse. He beats up on Rahm Emanuel. If that was a fight, they'd stop it every weekend, too, on ABC News. And I'm just looking forward to 2024. We'll get through this. We're not going to pack the Supreme Court. We're not going to raise taxes through the ceiling. We're not, you know, it's already broken. The Democrats are down to two people in the House. They'll get back up to five eventually, but they're going to break apart as they get close to 2022 and the redistricting comes through. And they are going to be worried about getting wiped out, which is what's going to happen to them. And they're going to start hiding from Nancy Pelosi, who's done. She's finished. She's out of here. Joe Biden doesn't know what day it is when it comes to the election, how long away it is. So he keeps saying crazy stuff. I'm just, my gosh, the Judiciary Committee is going to be a lot of fun. Ladies and gentlemen, I'll tell you this. There has never been a more important time to protect your digital rights. That's why I and thousands of my patriotic listeners choose to secure our online data by using ExpressVPN. Do you believe that a VPN isn't for you because you can use the internet just fine without one? Anytime you go online, my friends, your internet service provider can see every site you are visiting. You think that VPNs are complex and only for tech experts? No, they're not. Trust me. With ExpressVPN, you launch the app, tap one button to protect yourself, and it's done. It's that simple. I trust ExpressVPN to protect my online data because they're rated number one by CNET and Wired. And they stand for my values. So now is the time for you to take a stance. Take back your privacy at expressvpn.com/Hewitt. You get 3 extra months for on a 1-year package. That's expressvpn.com/Hewitt to get 3 extra months free. Visit expressvpn.com/Hewitt right now. Welcome back, America. Whether you know it or not, today is Independence Day in the great state of Israel. I'm joined by Dr. Michael Oren from Israel. Happy Independence Day to you, Dr. Oren, which I just found out follows Memorial Day, And I didn't know that. And so a happy Memorial Day, too. I was touched by some of the ceremonies I saw at the Times for Israel. But this is a big, big week for you guys.
It you know, it's a strange custom, but it's one that no Israeli wants to change. So what is it? We go into a Memorial Day. Memorial Day in Israel is not like a Memorial Day in the United States. There's no barbecues. There's no sales. Everyone goes into profound, profound, poignant mourning for 24 hours. There's no programming on TV except programs about fallen soldiers, victims of terror, and many, many ceremonies. And we stand for a siren and memorial twice. And then as the sun goes down, and, you know, in Jewish tradition, the next day begins when the sun goes down, you begin celebrating. You go from profound mourning to joy. And what can I say? It's extraordinary. And, you know, Israel is 73 years old. We have a lot to be happy about. We've just come out of Corona. We're the first, you know, fully vaccinated and herd immune country in the world. And yes, our political situation is in a total morass. But other than that, it's looking good.
Yeah, Dr. Arnn, I was thinking about this last night. Patriotism in Israel is genuine. Anger, political anger, is genuine. The media is genuine. I know there's a lot of backroom stuff going on. I want you to fill me in on that. But I do think it's more genuine than the American media state. Now, I don't live bathed in Israeli media, so I don't know if you have the fake news, real news argument. I don't know if you've got left, right, and center media. I don't know if you're just worn out by the media wars as we are in the United States. But it just seems a whole lot more authentic. I don't think I'm qualified for Aliyah. My wife is. She can make Aliyah. Can I come with her? Am I allowed to do that if she makes Aliyah?
You are.
It's just checking.
It's a whole different thing. There's a poll taken every year, an international poll. What are the most patriotic countries in the world? And there's only two countries that come out totally on top. One is the United States of America, and the other is the State of Israel. Though Israel tends to edge out of the United States in the question, is your country worth fighting for? Interestingly, we come out number one on that. And we have protests here, a big protest. But in the protest, people don't burn the Israeli flag. People fly the Israeli flag. So the protests are also an act of patriotism here. And I think that's a difference, certainly, from the America we saw last summer.
No, I can read Israeli history. It's only 73 years old, unless you count the Zionist movement. But I can read it all day long. Fill me in. Bennett and Netanyahu are behind closed doors a lot. They need Ram to at least let them organize. There's some of the Orthodox who say not now, not ever, never. What's going on? What's the gossip?
The gossip is that nothing's much going to happen coalition-wise. It's because one of the coalition partners, party headed by this gentleman with the unpronounceable name of Bezalel Smotrich, he's a little bit to the right of Bennett. His party took an internal poll, and they decided they would not sit with the Muslim extremists of Ram. So that basically throws the whole system into sort of a deadlock. And now the scuttlebutt is that Netanyahu is maneuvering to get himself elected president of Israel because the current president, Ruvi Rivlin, is concluding his term. It's a seven-year term. And, you know, I bet a year ago, if he would have asked most Israelis on the left, if they would have voted for Bibi to be president, they would have said yes, just to get him out of politics. Now, I'm not so certain.
Why?
Because the presidency has a lot of respect here. It's like the German presidency. It's a ceremonial job. It's a job that's meant to unite Israelis, not divide Israelis. It's not supposed to be political in the sense is that Netanyahu will be very, very political, even more so than Shimon Peres. And then he's still facing these corruption charges. And what it will look like for the State of Israel to have his president in court several times a week.
All right, now, I also read, because, again, I read obsessively about this because it's like Game of Thrones without the bloodshed. We've got it's just wonderful. We've got the idea that Sa'ar could be made president, and then that would New Hope? And then you got six free agents running around. What about that?
That's a possibility, too. It has been vetted. It's been, you know, raised the possibility to make Sa'ar the president. He'd be a very, very good president, by the way. He would be a uniting figure. There's all this different arithmetic. At the end of the day, if it doesn't come through, we go to another round of elections, and we'll keep going along the elections, I think, as long as Benjamin Netanyahu is the head of the Likud party.
So here's my American view of this. I just don't get it. I am a right-winger. I've been a right-winger my whole life. I say that proudly, and they say that proudly in Israel. It means I'm right of center, not crazy. I'm just a right-winger. You got all these right-wingers. You want a right-wing government. You can do free enterprise. You can reform the judiciary and get all this stuff done. If somebody swallows their pride and gets the hell out of the way, is that going to happen?
Yeah, it's not necessarily a matter of pride. In the case of, say, Smotrich not willing to sit with Islamic extremists.
That's not a matter of pride. That's a matter of ideology.
That's not a matter of pride. Yeah. He defended I think I mentioned on last week's program, about a week and a half ago, a Palestinian Israeli Arab who had killed an Israeli soldier 35 years ago was released from prison. He went back to his village and was hailed as a hero coming home. And members of this Ram extremist party were there to hug him. Now, you can't say to a lot of Israelis, hey, you want to sit in the government with these people? It's very difficult. That's not ego. That's substance.
And, but what about the right-wingers, Saar and Bennett and Netanyahu? They've got 60-plus votes.
But Saar hates Bibi.
I don't care. There are 8 million Israelis that need free enterprise. Honestly, next week, Oren, you have to explain this to me. Dr. Michael Oren, former ambassador to the United States, former deputy minister of Israel, one of our favorite guests. Thank you, Dr. Oren. Follow him on Twitter at Dr. Michael Oren. Follow me to hour two of today's Hugh Hewitt Show. Morning, glory, America. Bonjour, hi, Canada. It's Hugh Hewitt inside Castle Gorka today because the internet never works when it rains in my part of Northern Virginia. I don't know if Simon Kim experiences that. She's a senior correspondent with the Washington Post covering the White House and Congress. Sungmin, does the internet in your neighborhood just go to hell whenever it rains? Because Xfinity may be the worst. It just does. If it rains, then it doesn't work. And I have to go to the high ground of Castle Gorka in Transylvania and hold forth from there. What happens to you when it rains? Does it work at the Post?
Both at home and at the Post, it seems to be fine, even in hard rain, but that's got to be frustrating here.
Oh, no, I'm near the river. I think if the river hits a certain level, it floods Xfinity's underground bastion, and they have to flee. And I have to go to the high ground. And I don't like Castle Gorka. It's got these barricades and angry gargoyles on it, and it's just... If the wind whistles around the turrets at the top, and I'm up in the right tower. Hey, Sungmin, I got to ask you, number one, did you know Tom Cotton got on Judiciary? Did anyone tell you?
They announced the slate, several weeks ago once they finally got the Senate organized, and I thought that was a pretty interesting move. Obviously, a very important committee on a lot of fascinating issues. We know Tom Cotton's an ambitious man, and he's talked a lot about issues like immigration and guns in the past. So it kind of makes sense that he got a spot on that committee.
Well, it's the murderer's row of Republican committees. I'm actually kind of looking forward to Justice Breyer's retirement, which I think is happening in June. And they're going to send up a very well-qualified nominee. They'll know that it's going to be an African-American woman. We know that. And I think I know who it's going to be. And she's going to be very well-qualified. But it's still going to be fun because it's the murderer's row. Cruz and Lee and Hawley and Cotton and Ben Sass. It's the murderer's row of, like, the smart senators. And Cotton yesterday took Kristen Clark apart. And when Dick Durbin tried to shut him up, Dick Durbin turned into Brave Sir Robin. Can we have the music, please? Do we have Brave Sir Robin music? I don't know if Sungmin is a are you familiar with Brave Sir Robin, Sungmin?
I am actually not.
You don't know Brave Sir Robin? All right, hit the music, Adam. Oh, no, it's not ready. Honestly, did the internet take it out, too? He was busy editing it. You've never heard this, Sungmin.
I don't think so.
Oh, my gosh. You kids. I do not believe half of the cultural references made for people over the age of 60 are to Monty Python and the Holy Grail. Seinfeld accounts for the other half of our cultural references. And before the 2016 debate, CNN would whisper in my ear, no Seinfeld jokes, right before, because they knew that there were people like you who would not get them. You've got to watch Monty Python and the Holy Grail. You've never watched it.
I have seen it, but I just don't remember that part. I remember kind of the other big parts. But
well, Dick Durbin is Brave Sir Robin. And yesterday, Cotton took him apart after Ted Cruz took him apart. He's like a Zorro victim. And this is the greatest committee in the world. When do you expect, by the way, a vote on Kristen Clark? They're left-wing radical nominee for the Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights?
It won't be for a couple of weeks. As you know, I mean, obviously she just had her confirmation hearing yesterday. There are usually a few days for various paperwork, questions for the record to come back to the committee. I'm sure Republicans will have several follow-up questions for Kristen Clark. And then just the way the committee works, any one member can delay a vote happening for at least a week. So that means we're at least a couple of weeks out from just a committee vote and maybe perhaps confirmation or confirmation on the full floor, maybe sometime in May.
There will be no Republican who votes for. So the question is whether Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema and especially Margaret Hassan in New Hampshire and Commander Kelly, Captain Kelly, I always demote him and he's a captain. Captain Senator Kelly in Arizona vote for her and other allegedly centrists, but they're all left wingers in the Senate. Now, I want to talk about the commission that President Biden put together. And Sungmin, you got this unusual job that puts you at the triangulation of the court and judiciary in the White House. Have you actually walked through the membership and not taken the party line? The party line from the White House is what a bipartisan commission. Well, I know Jack Goldsmith. Jack Goldsmith is a radio friend of mine, and I admire him and respect him. And I know the other alleged conservatives on there. It is a overwhelmingly left. And I've been teaching con law for 25 years. It is an overwhelmingly left-wing group of people. I mean, it's not even close to the center. It's hard. Hard left and very young and very inexperienced, zero practice experience. I can't say zero. Bob Bauer has been a left wing warrior forever. Have you done a deep dive into this commission yet?
I have not, but that's a fascinating point that you raise because we always kind of look at a commission as a way of punting, or here in Washington, as a way of kind of punting decisions down the road. Or when you don't want to have to take an answer on a topic such as, you know, do you support expanding the Supreme Court, which is a question that Biden has faced and obviously has deferred from the base of his party on. But the fact that the makeup of the commission seems to be kind of leading a certain way is an interesting point.
Okay, and I expect you to be a good reporter and not commit yourself. When you investigate who these people are, and they're wonderful people. Believe me, I think Lawrence Tribe has done great things for the law. He's a hard left winger. I think Jack Goldsmith has done great things for the law. He's a center right guy. I'm kind of a Jack Goldsmith guy when it comes to con law. There are no genuine hardcore originalists. If you had the Federalist Society evaluate this commission, they would laugh and laugh and laugh. It's not even close. And Bob Bauer is a political operator. There's no other. He's not a scholar. He's a professor of practice, which means he can't actually get tenured because he doesn't know. He's never done any research in the law or done any teaching. It's just the damnedest thing. And now the House Democrats, even though it's left wing, are not waiting. They're bringing a court packing bill. And I want to know if you've got any reports on when. I want that to get a vote on the House floor like yesterday. I want that voted on immediately to move the court from 9 to 13. And Guy Benson's with me on this. Let's get this thing moved to the floor, discharged. When will that get a vote?
That's a good question. I mean, this is, you know, Nancy Pelosi, in terms of the House, does not like putting up bills that will make her more moderate members uncomfortable in order to satisfy the base of her party. So if the frontliners in the House are uncomfortable with this, which I suspect they might be, it may never see a vote. But remember, in the Senate, particularly in the Senate, there are ways for parties to force tough votes on another, and that's through the reconciliation, through the budget process. We saw a lot of that several weeks ago when the Senate was taking up the coronavirus relief package. And, you know, as much as Democrats are preaching bipartisanship right now, I think everyone in Washington expects this jobs plan, the $2.25 trillion jobs plan, to go through reconciliation. So you're going to have that big voterama on the floor. And I would not be surprised if, a Tom Cotton or someone else on judiciary forces a vote on, legislation that would expand the number of Supreme Court justices from 9 to 13, like these House Democrats and Senator Ed Markey have proposed.
And in the House, the Appropriations Committee can offer up in committee votes to defund this commission. It's the old Democratic playbook. When I was back in the Reagan days, I have Karen Tumulty on today to talk about the Reagan days and her fine, excellent new book, The Triumph of Nancy Reagan. You just attach an appropriation rider forbidding any additional funding for the left-wing crazy commission on courts. And the Democrats will either support it or not support it. And on any plan to expand the court, you're able to do it in the House, at least at the committee level. But does the House not have the equivalent of the Senate votorama? Sungmin Kim?
Not quite. Definitely not in the scale and scope and just kind of the freedom to able for any one member to offer amendments like the Senate Votorama does. Now, what the House can do, what the House minority, in this case House Republicans, can do is offer what's called a motion to recommit on the floor, but that's a specific bill, a specific policy that's decided by leadership. So certainly this is a path that Kevin McCarthy could take on kind of a relevant bill that Democrats are pushing, but it's a much likelier chance, I believe, in the Senate when the process is a lot more free-flowing and all 100 members have the ability to offer something.
Very quickly, we've got President Biden sending an unofficial committee to unofficial Taiwan, including former and unofficial Chris Dodd and former and unofficial Rick Armitage and former and unofficial other deputy secretary. It's very unofficial because they got rocked in Anchorage. Tony Blinken and Jake Sullivan took right uppercuts from Mr. Yang. I'll be writing about this for the Washington Post a little bit later in the day. Is Team Biden aware that they look like appeasers right now? And John Kerry's running off to China to do climate stuff. Do they get it that they look like, you know, Neville Chamberlain right now?
I think they've answered a lot of questions about that Anchorage incident, and clearly foreign policy is a big issue for them this week with all the news, but certainly that's something that they're continuing to face questions on.
Sungmin Kim, I look forward to continuing. I read your piece on refugees. I just didn't think it was as interesting as the threshing field the Judiciary Committee has become. Good to talk to you as always, Sungmin Kim in the Washington Post. Stay tuned, America. It's the Hugh Hewitt Show from Castle Gorka. Brave Sir Robin, played by Eric Idle, a great, great Monty Python cast member in the infamous and famous movie Monty Python and the Holy Grail. Brave Sir Robin ran away. And the brave Sir Robin in the Senate is Dick Durbin, and he chairs the Judiciary Committee, and he tried to get in the way of Ted Cruz and Tom Cotton yesterday, and he ran away. Another member of the committee is Marsha Blackburn, Tennessee's own, and she joins us this morning. Good morning, Senator. How are you?
I'm glad to join you, and you are right. We're trying to make certain that the Senate Judiciary Committee abides by the rules. Quite a novel idea, right?
Dick Durbin was embarrassed yesterday. I got to ask you about him. I know the rules of the Senate are never to speak ill of another senator, but I want you to know, number one, we've got a brand new affiliate in Spartan, Tennessee this week, News Talk 1050 AM in Sparta. We know that's close to the 40 and serves Nashville as well, and so we're glad to have them on board with us, Senator Blackburn. We've just got all of Tennessee covered. I'm going to have to get a studio down in Nashville, maybe do a little recording. And yeah, but, you know, you saw that yesterday. Dick Durbin has taken over for Senator Feinstein as the chair, and he keeps cutting off the Republicans. How long is that going to go on for? Tom Cotton took his head off, but I want him to be like Brave Sir Robin.
One of the things that we are doing is pushing the effort for the Senate Judiciary Committee to abide by the rules of the committee. And what had happened was previously during a debate, Dick Durbin cut Tom Cotton off and didn't let him have his say. Likewise, Tom Tillis. And then moved for the vote. And what we are doing is pushing to make certain that the rules are abided by, that all members are going to be heard. I mean, this is just unbelievable that you would actually have a committee where the members would not be heard. And bear in mind, it's not like the Democrats have a majority of 10 votes in that committee. It is a 50-50 committee, but because of the vice president, a 50-50 Senate is the majority goes to the party of the vice president.
Well, we get that, but normally the party of the vice president, normally every senator abides by the rule when they're in the chair. And I have watched for years as Democrats have abused the rules in the minority. Now they're going to abuse the minority in the pseudo-majority that is a 50-50 Senate. And I'm just curious I want to get to the substance of Kristen Clark in a second, whether or not the committee is meeting on how to organize resistance to Durbin. Because I think he'll fold. He folds like a chair. He's a beach chair of a chairman. He's brave Sir Robin. Do you think he's going to fold on this stuff?
Well, we don't know. But what we do know is pardon me, we can develop our game plan, which we are doing. We can challenge, we can push for the Senate judiciary and indeed all committees to abide by the rules. And you know what, Hugh, that is what we're going to do. What the Democrats are doing is they know they're going to lose the majority in 2022. So whether it's the House, whether it's the Senate, they are running like a bulldozer trying to just force through their will, whether it's packing the court, whether it's H.R. 1, you name it. They are Green New Deal. They're just going to it.
Does H.R. 1 come through judiciary?
There will be parts of H.R. 1 to come through judiciary, yes.
Okay, great, because that will be a good show. I'll like that show. Yesterday, the House Democrats introduced a bill to expand the Supreme Court from 9 to 13, just flat out court packing. They don't want to wait for the left-wing commission Joe Biden put together. They just want to, I want that to get the vote. I want every Democrat on the record about expanding the Supreme Court. That's an attack on the fundamental rule of law. That's the upending of everything we know to be about the sanctity of freedom and liberty in the United States if you just want to change the rules by adding left-wing judges. Do you want to get a vote on that in Votorama at the next reconciliation, Senator Marsha Blackburn?
I think you'll see this one move as a standalone bill. The Democrats right now are very emboldened. They think they can get their way. They think the only way, their only hope of maintaining control is to get in here, and what are they going to do? They are going to try to force things through, like H.R. 1, so that they federalize elections, so that they end up stripping your local election commission in your county of any power and any ability to run your election. They would federalize this. So just imagine having an entity like the IRS running elections.
But let me stick with me on court packing, because I think everybody understands court packing. H.R. 1 is such a ridiculous monstrosity. I don't worry about that getting through. It'll never get 60 votes, and it's not reconciliationable. It can't get. I think maybe the Supreme Court could be reconciliationable by providing the funding for four new justices. I'm not sure. I'm not the Senate parliamentarian. If the Votorama comes up on reconciliation, will you offer an amendment to ban Supreme Court packing? Because I would like to see, and you're going to have another Votorama, I would like to see every Democratic senator on the record on that.
Well, and we'll have our game plan. We will move forward with blocking them. Of course, the last Votorama that we had, what did they end up doing? They stripped out the amendments, and then they went back to their original bill. And Schumer is already saying that is what they're going to do. And, of course, what they're doing, Q, we all say elections have consequences, but this is election means punishment. And what they're trying to do is punish the American people, punish conservatives. And when it comes to court packing, they do not want an equal justice court. And that is one thing that your listeners need to bear in mind. This is not about equal justice. This is about we want to nail you and all conservatives to the wall. And if you do not submit and if you do not conform, we're going to beat the hell out of you.
Well, I agree. That's the message. Loud and clear, that's the message. Now, Senator, I've got a petition over at HughHewitt.com to support election integrity and stand with Georgia. And now that Major League Baseball is a blue sport and Delta Airlines is a blue airline and Coca-Cola is a Democratic blue soft drink, we want people to recognize the Georgia law was a good law. It was a voter integrity law. It was balanced. It was fair. It was well thought out. There was a lot of debate. There was a lot of input. It's a fine law, and Democrats are running a propaganda war against it. Do you stand with Georgia and what they did? Do you think what they did was good state-driven voter reform?
Yes, I think that what Georgia did was to take the steps to make certain that everyone has the opportunity to vote and that all legal votes are counted and included in the process. and that votes that are not legally cast is something that is not going to be counted, because we want each person to have their vote and for that vote to be counted. And Hugh, when you look at what happened with Georgia, the clarity that they brought to cleaning up their law, something that they should have done on the front end, not the back end. And then you had the word is Stacey Abrams kind of led the push to get this out, to get the All-Star game out of Georgia, and started this. Look at what she is doing to the people of the great state of Georgia.
Now, Major League Baseball decided to become a Democratic operative. Okay, so Rob Manfred, their commissioner, decided to line up with the Democrats and make it a Democratic sport. They have an antitrust exemption by act of Congress. I want that revoked. Ted Cruz has brought a bill to do so.
Well, we've already filed that bill. Yeah, there are several of us that are on that bill, yes.
And so when does that get a hearing? And because the Democrats don't believe in cartels, they should support you. Right. They should support you in getting rid of Major League Baseball's antitrust exemption. Have you had any Democrat co-signers on the bill?
No, we have not.
Did you ask them?
Well, they're always welcome. We would love to have bills that are going to be bipartisan bills moving forward. And there is an opportunity for them to join us on that, just as there is an opportunity for them to join some of my legislation dealing with online privacy and with Section 230. The Democrats are welcome to put the focus on good governance. We would hope that they would come to their senses and realize what these companies have done is wrong. Georgia was right to clean up their election laws. They were embarrassed by what transpired in the 2020 elections. Other states are cleaning up their election laws. So now what are these companies going to do? Are they going to say half of our customers, half of our shareholders are center right, so we're just going to throw them to the curb and we're going to go all in with the leftists?
The customers are throwing them to the curb. Last question, Senator Blackburn. Yesterday, Jadeveon Clowney made a decision. I think it was a great decision. He decided to leave the Titans and join the Browns. I hope you will agree with me that the free market is a wonderful thing when one of the best defensive ends in football can leave Tennessee and come to Ohio.
Well, I think what he'll realize very soon is he's going to have less take-home pay, because in Tennessee we have no state income tax.
Well, we gave him enough money in Cleveland. You know, I just got to say that the Cleveland front office did a good thing. Senator Blackburn, always good to talk to you and to the people of Sparta. She's a frequent guest. You'll hear your own senator along with Senator Hagerty often on this show. Thank you, Senator Blackburn. The fact is, the internet never forgets. There has never been a more important time to protect your internet activity, your digital data. That's why I urge you to get ExpressVPN. Everything you search for, watch, or click online can be tracked back to you by big tech companies, and they do it. They match your activity to your true identity using your device's unique IP address. That's why you need to switch, and I switch, to ExpressVPN. On your computer, on your phone, every IP address is masked by a secure VPN server, which makes it harder for websites to identify me. Plus, you can use ExpressVPN on up to 5 devices simultaneously. That's why they're rated the number one VPN by CNET and Wired. So stop handing over your data to big tech companies. Go with the VPN I trust for online protection. Visit expressvpn.com/Hewitt to get 3 months free on a 1-year package. That's expressvpn.com/Hewitt. To get 3 extra months for free, go to expressvpn.com/Hewitt right now to learn more. Welcome back, America. It's Hugh Hewitt. Later this morning, the Washington Post will carry a new column by me advocating the jettisoning of strategic ambiguity and a clear declaration from Team Biden that if force is used against Taiwan, we will respond force for force. Navy for Navy, plane for plane, cyber for cyber. And Jim Talent joins me, former senator from Missouri, defense expert. What about strategic ambiguity, Senator Talent? Is it time to jettison that nefarious doctrine?
Well, let me set the stage, you, before I get to that question, if I can. Okay.
Please.
So what we're facing, and I loved your interviews with Stav and Kot, what we're facing in China's near seas, and to a lesser extent in Eastern Europe, is the prospect of strategic failure. And that occurs when, in the face of aggression, the United States has only two options, either to forfeit a vital national interest, such as the integrity of Taiwan, or to fight under very unfavorable circumstances where there's a high prospect either of defeat or unacceptable losses. And that's where we're at. And we are there because deterrence is failing, because as you and I and a few other people have been saying for a number of years, we have allowed our deterrent power in these regions to decline to the point where the aggressors believe quite plausibly they can defeat us. So that's where we're at, okay?
Yep.
Now, what do we do about it? My concern, I mean, I don't think the issue is so much the policy you, because I think the Chinese are planning on the assumption that we will defend Taiwan. I don't think it's a question where they think we won't, although they know there's a possibility that we won't. The issue is whether we can. And so whatever we do with regard to the policy, we have to take action. And the short-term actions that we need to take is to strengthen deterrence in any way possible in their near seas. Now, unfortunately, because we have not prepared for this, there aren't a whole lot of things we can do, but we can get missile systems within range that can threaten Chinese assets in the event that they actually invade Taiwan, which would require, as you know, a considerable fleet, a lot of shipping, et cetera. So, for example, basing Aegis Ashore systems in Taiwan so that we confront them with the prospect of hundreds of short-range missiles that could take out their ships and their planes, mining the strait more, getting longer-range cruise missiles based in the region. I mean, the problem we have here, and Stav is right, of course, we have enormous striking power with aircraft carriers, but the issue is, can they get within range because of the Chinese ballistic and cruise anti-ship missiles?
Okay? Now, I've got a technical question, Senator. The Japan is home to Atsugi and home to other facilities in the Marine Corps on Okinawa where aircraft can be based. Do we have aircraft that are capable of leaving Japan and striking targets in the Taiwan Straits?
We have a few long-range precision strike bombers, the B-2, but the problem is we only have, a couple dozen of them. Some of them aren't ready at any given time, and my understanding is their ordnance is not the kind of ordnance that we need to be able to be effective in that kind of a fight. You get into technical issues, just write that question down for Stav.
Stav won't tell me anything because he knows everything, and he can't. I asked him, how many attack submarines do we have in the Taiwan area, and he wouldn't talk to me.
And you're right to focus on that, because the domain where we still have a clear advantage is the undersea domain. And the Virginia-class attack sub, as we've talked about, is, I still think, the deadliest platform that could engage. Now, the problem is, we have not brought them online quickly enough to replace the older attack submarines, and so we're going to bottom out in the number of submarines in the next 5 or 6 years. That's why Davidson was talking in terms – one of the reasons he was talking in terms of this 5 or 6 year time frame. I mean, we do have systems coming online which will strengthen deterrence, but what happens in the short term?
You're our mutual friend, Dr. Hendricks, Captain Hendricks, who wrote the book To Provide and Maintain – talked to me this week and told me, and the other problem, we got no place to service these subs on the West Coast. Mare Island ought to be revitalized, rebuilt in the reconstruction of the infrastructure bill, so that submarines that need refurbishing, and indeed, you could build them there, too, if you want. We don't build them there right now. You could pour enough money into Mare Island in California, maybe get the blue senators to vote for it. We just can't keep them at sea forever, and they got to be, I guess they're very fast and they're very lethal, but eventually they got to come home, right?
Yeah, exactly. So we don't have the infrastructure of deterrence either. Now, you take Eastern Europe, and you're right, Putin and the Chinese are coordinating, okay? So when I did the QDR Strategic Review Panel, the second one in 2014, we talked to the Department of Defense at the time. This was when Putin was really ramping all this stuff up. And Rand has done studies on this. If we could base 5 or 6 brigades someplace in Eastern Europe, with a couple of hundred tanks and a supporting infrastructure, we would put paid to what Putin is thinking about doing and threatening to do. I mean, that would largely be the deterrent, but the army isn't big enough. We don't have 25,000 men. Now, how can a nation of 330 million people, with the kind of interest we have around the world, and given what's at stake if we get an escalating armed conflict, not have the men to be able to do that? Well, it's because of exactly what you and I have been complaining about for the last 15 years.
And we will continue to complain about it. Appeasement does not work. We have an appeasement administration right now, and I'll be writing about that in the Washington Post today. Jim Talent is on Twitter. Follow him from the Bipartisan Policy Center. Follow everything he says on defense, and hopefully Team Biden will follow his lead. Stay tuned, America. Hour number three of the Hugh Hewitt Show. Straight ahead. Morning, glory, America. Bonjour, hi, Canada. Hugh Hewitt inside the Beltway, but I had to retreat from my studio because Xfinity, it always shorts out whenever it rains and I'm near the river, so I had to retreat to Castle Gorka. So I'm up on the high ground at Castle Gorka this morning, but pleased to welcome back the GOP whip in the House of Representatives, Steve Scalise from the great state of Louisiana. Representative Scalise, welcome back to the Hugh Hewitt Show.
It's great to be back with you. I hope you're doing well.
I'm doing great. We're getting close to the draft. And as you may know, the Cleveland Browns have made a specialty of getting LSU Tigers. We've got, you know, Odell Beckham Jr. and Grant Delpit. We got other LSU Tigers. I'm looking. All you got are wide receivers. We need DBs. I'm not sure we're going to have a Tiger drafted to the Browns this year.
It'll be a first for a while. But, you've done well with it. You go down the road in Cincinnati. They got Joe Burrow. So, you know, look, we're going to have a few more Tigers drafted. Saints need a few upgrades, too, but we're going to be a Super Bowl contender this year.
Yeah. Okay. Steve Scalise.
Right.
I will write that down, and I'll say I'm not going to Vegas with that one. Let's hope you've got better information on the House court packing bill. Look, this is my favorite bill of the year. I want this to get a vote tomorrow. Democrats introduced legislation yesterday to pack the Supreme Court to expand it from 9 to 13. The single most radical bill in the House of Representatives since before the Civil War. It is that radical. And I want it to get a vote, Steve Scalise. Can you help it get a vote in a hurry?
Let's push them to vote on, go on the record on all this stuff. Look, when you talk about radical, all that Speaker Pelosi has done this whole year is move a radical socialist agenda. And you've got every Democrat almost single across the board, every Democrat voting, you know, for rewriting our national voting laws to ban states from showing ID, to mandate same-day voter registration, things that would guarantee voter fraud in every state, to turn the United States into California. In terms of voting, I don't think that's where America is. They're getting ready to go raise taxes on everybody. You know, the idea that, oh, don't worry, just the millionaires and billionaires are going to pay. Does anybody really believe that when the guy who's chairman of the Senate Budget Committee writing the bill is named Bernie Sanders? Do you really think you're not going to pay more on your utility bill? You absolutely, $50,000 a year hardworking family is going to pay more in taxes if Democrats get their way.
I want to come back to court packing in a second, but you reminded me yesterday I was talking to the president of the Job Creators Network, which is the best small business organization in America, Alfredo Ortiz. And Alfredo and I were talking about stepped up basis because I'm urging him to make this a focal point. It's not a millionaire's provision. It's a small business provision. It protects family farms and family car washes and family restaurants, and it protects success. And the Democrats want to get rid of stepped up basis. Steve Scalise, do you think the Republicans can explain to America how radical the elimination of stepped up basis, even when a company with a $1 million exemption is?
Well, you know, if you go back to the death tax, when it was branded as the death tax, people got that. And look, it's how you explain it to people when they think somebody else might pay the tax. Sometimes people might in a poll say they might be okay with it. People innately know they're going to pay these tax hikes. Every working class family, no one will be immune from Biden and Pelosi's radical tax hikes. You know, it's like packing the court. It's like the open border policies. They are radicals, and America is still a center-right nation. And we've got to keep pointing it out. We've been highlighting this border crisis, and it's breaking through. If they try to pack the court, that will break through as an issue that people say, wait a minute, you know, President Biden, you promised to be a unifier. You still haven't even met with House Republican leadership on any issue. That's not unification. That's radicalization. That's not where America is.
Well, put your arms around stepped-up basis, because I believe America's middle class depends upon it to pass on success and hard work and the McDonald's franchise that someone built with nothing to something. And every 7-Eleven out there, it is a crushing, crushing tax to do eliminate stepped-up basis.
Well, it's like subchapter S's. I mean, if you're a pass-through company, people might not, you know, they might have to talk to their accountant to know what that means. But if you look on paper like you're a multimillionaire, but really you're running your business through as a subchapter S, which many small businesses do, you personally aren't a millionaire. You just happen to hire a lot of people, and that all shows up on your personal income tax. You raise that person's rate, they're going to have to reduce their business. They might have to lay workers off. They won't be able to give a Christmas bonus like they did last year. It has devastating impacts on working families.
100% correct.
Messing with the tax code. Like
and
that.
If you get rid of stepped up basis, they have to sell that business at the death of the owner, and those families go out of business. I had a farmer from Iowa call me the first day that this was on the board. He said, "That's it. I'm a 5-generation farmer. We're done. If that passes, I have to sell the farm. My kids can't do it. They're on the farm now."
What we can do is let's work on a term other than stepped up basis so that people get it, like the death tax.
Yeah, it's a success tax.
Inheritance tax or the wealth tax. People think it's, you know, your millionaires and billionaires are getting some loophole. If you say, wait, the family farm is going to have to be sold if the owner dies who paid taxes on it, people think that's not fair. So I think we'll come up with a better terminology for stepped up basis. But if you start messing with it, you and I know it will crush jobs in America, just like the Green New Deal would, just like the Paris Accord would. They're all job killing ideas that are going to reduce the paychecks of hardworking families.
And I give credit where credit is due. Alfredo Ortiz of the Job Creators Network told me it's a success tax. And I like that because it is a tax.
There we go. Now we've got it.
I know. Alfredo gets the credit.
That's how you tag it.
Trademark.
I'll have to bring Alfredo to meet with the WIT team.
Yeah, bring him in. He's Job Creators Alliance. Now, let me talk to you about this Supreme Court packing. It is a nightmare for them. They'll get wiped out in 2022. No American wants to screw around with our rule of law. So how do we get it to a vote? Now, go into the weeds with me, Whip Scalise. This audience is smart. This audience doesn't need to have tutorials. They just need, how do you get it done? How do you get it to a vote?
Well, there's different ways. And look, we force votes on things like defunding police because every Democrat's scared to death to talk about it, but they all supported it in various ways. They supported defunding the police, even though America doesn't. So there's ways we'll surely look at where the best place is to get Democrats on record. Look, they were trying to steal a seat in Iowa. Marionette Miller Meeks won her race by 6 votes out of hundreds of thousands. Pelosi was trying to take the seat away just because we started getting Democrats to be asked the question back home in their districts. There were enough of them that said, well, wait a minute, I don't want to vote to steal that seat away. She was duly elected in Iowa. And once there were over 5 who said they wouldn't do it, Pelosi knew she didn't have the votes, and so she pulled it. So let's start getting people on record.
Can you get a discharge petition, which every Republican signs, to move that bill out of committee? Is that a tool that's available to you? Because honestly, they will run from court packing. They know that most of America thinks that is a nightmare idea. Joe Biden knows it's a nightmare idea. Can you discharge petition that Democrat bill to the floor to get a vote on it?
Well, let me go take a look at the best way to highlight it. I will tell you this. Yesterday, as you're talking about discharge, yesterday, we broke the record for the history of Congress. Most people to sign a discharge petition on its first day was yesterday on Ann Wagner's Born Alive Act. So Kat Kamak from Florida did the discharge petition. 202 Republicans signed onto that bill, which says if a baby's born alive outside the womb, in some Democrat states, they let you kill the baby and call it abortion. It's murder. You and I know it's murder, but it's legal in some states. We outlaw that with this bill. 16 more people need to sign on, including only 5 Democrats. If 5 Democrats sign that discharge, it's brought to the floor and it will pass, protecting. We're not just talking about unborn lives now. These are babies who are born alive and are still murdered after they're born, and it's called abortion. We can ban that practice with a discharge petition.
You've got to go get the rest of the Republicans because that's electoral suicide.
Some are not in Washington yesterday. We will get every Republican. I will make that pledge to you right now. Then we need just 5 Democrats. And by the way, there are more than 5 Democrats who ran saying they're pro-life. You're not pro-life if you do not sign the discharge petition on the Born Alive.
I agree. But I also think if every Republican signed a discharge petition on court packing and said, let's bring it up, we'll vote against it then, Democrats are put in a corner because they'll run away from that. You know they'll hide from that, yeah. Steve Scalise.
Well, now that there's an actual bill, and it's Jerry Nadler's bill. Everybody knows Jerry Nadler.
I love that.
Now that there's a bill, we all need to start asking every Democrat, what is your position on Jerry Nadler's radical court packing bill?
But okay, last question for you. Good. Last question. I can't wait to see the new lines and the new redistricting lines, because I know what the Democrats will do in Maryland and Massachusetts. They'll gerrymander, and I know Republicans will gerrymander in Texas and Florida, and that's fine. That's the way the system works. When are we going to get the numbers so that these states can go to work, Congressman?
Yeah, can you believe the Biden administration has been slow walking this stuff? And I think in part it's because if the numbers came out today, New York State would lose 2 seats in Congress. California loses 1. California has never lost seats in the history of the state of California. They're going to lose a seat. New York should lose 2. If you see the numbers come out in August and New York only loses 1, which means Alabama would then lose a seat, it's because they played games with the numbers. But let's get the numbers out now. There's no reason it should delay till August or September.
Okay, we're cooking the books as we speak. Steve Scalise, love having you on. I hope we get some LSU Tigers up to Cleveland again, because we're winning the Super Bowl this year. Not so sure about your Saints, but great to talk to you, Steve. Don't go anywhere, America. It's the Hugh Hewitt Show.